It's more than just words on a page, more than ink and paper. It's a universe waiting to be explored, to learn from, to laugh with, to see life through a different lens. Every story leaves its mark, and every reader leaves with a bookmark. Welcome to The Bookmark with Batya Bricker.
Good afternoon, I'm Batya Bricker, and you are tuned to 101.9 Chai FM's book show, Bookmark, home of stories and the people who love them. Are accolades important? Do book awards even matter? There is something persuasive about that little sticker on a book jacket that confidently bursts out and proclaims winner of the Women's Fiction Prize or the Booker Prize. Awards somehow have a way of cutting through the noise in a very overcrowded literary world. And it offers a kind of shorthand, a promise almost, that this book has been seen, sifted, debated, and deemed worthy. From the gravitas of the Booker Prize to the cultural authority of the Pulitzer, and then the more populist ones, Goodreads Choice Awards, the hotly debated Nobel Prize in Literature, prizes shape not only what we read, but how we read. And for the writer, an award can launch a career, revive backlists, and catapult a relatively unknown author into a global conversation overnight. So a win can mean translations, adaptions, prize money, and crucially, readership. But what does that mean for the reader? If you've ever found yourself dutifully working your way through an award winner, and I know that I have done this, you sort of plod through out of obligation because everyone else said it was really good. So if that's you, you'll know that uneasy question that lingers beneath all the glitter and the hype. Does an award actually mean a book is good? Or more precisely, good for whom? Because good is actually a slippery thing. What one panel of judges finds daring and innovative, another reader may find dense and inaccessible. And often, awards reflect particular literary values, like structure or political relevance or cultural trends. They reward ambition, sometimes difficulty. But actually, as readers, what we're looking for often is pleasure, just sheer reading pleasure. That quite unnameable magic that makes you miss your bus or the pot boils over because you simply couldn't look up. So today we're going to delve into some of the books that did indeed catch the eyes of the judges, the readers, and the book world. I'd love to know if you've read a book that recently won an award, or even in the distant past, but that you found disappointing or it really fed you. Let me know on the SMS line 061-895-1019.
Turn the page. It's The Bookmark with Batya Bricker.
I'm Batya Bricker, and you are listening to 101.9 Chai FM's book show, Bookmark. And today we are talking about award winners, those titles on the shelves with those glitzy stickers that tell you this book is worth reading. And the first book I want to talk about is a book called James by Percival Everett. It won the National Book Award for Fiction, but also the 2025 Pulitzer Prize for fiction. The Pulitzer is the most prestigious award for fiction in the United States, and it hails from Columbia University, named after Joseph Pulitzer, who was a well-known journalist in the 1800s. And I've been wanting to talk about this book for a long time because it's truly exceptional. And just by the way, if you have not yet discovered Percival Everett, the author in general, it is high time that you pick up one of his books. He is one of America's most important writers, I think, at this time. And I know I'd recently picked up an older book of his called The Trees, couldn't put it down, and gave such a slice of American culture and thought, which influences so much of ours. Well worth reading. But this book, James, is an acclaimed novel. It reimagines the adventures of Huckleberry Finn, the classic, from the perspective of the enslaved character James, or as we know him, Jim. And the book has been lauded for exploring agency, family, and freedom. It's part of a massive trend of revisionist history that we're seeing on the shelves, real history and real stories being retold and re-understood through a different lens. It's a new perspective of an old story, a story that you may know and love, like in the case of Huckleberry Finn, but it's completely refreshed and totally new breath of fresh air, and it's incredibly powerful. So the story starts in the Mississippi River in 1861, when the enslaved Jim overhears that he is about to be sold to a new owner in New Orleans, and he is to be separated from his wife and daughter forever. And so he flees to nearby Jackson Island, where he can formulate a plan. Meanwhile, Huckleberry Finn, Huck Finn, has faked his own death to escape his violent father, who recently returned to town. And so begins a dangerous and transcendent journey through the Mississippi River towards the elusive promise of the free states and beyond. As James and Huck navigate the treacherous waters, each bend in the river holds the promise of salvation and demise, and together the unlikely pair embark on the most life-changing odyssey of their lives. What I loved about this was the glimpse into a slave's life and how the persona presented in front of his white owners was completely different to the sophisticated, educated interior of his own life, which he covers up so as not to look too clever, too smart, too educated, and not to show up his owners. It really made me think about the faces and the masks that we wear in the roles that we play. And obviously, it has such relevance to South Africa, understanding the internal worlds of people who work for us. I absolutely love this book and I highly recommend it. I wanted to talk about a book called Flesh. Flesh by David Zale won the prestigious 2025 Booker Prize. And the Booker Prize is the most prestigious award for fiction awarded to writers in the United States. The monetary award and the overall recognition boosts readership to such a degree that it is a highly covetable award. And the winner, in this case, David Zale, would have won £50,000 as the grand prize. And it really put him on the map. Now, if you go into the bookstores, you'll see this on all the top shelves of the award-winning sections. And Flesh tells the story of an alluring, enigmatic, and emotionally detached man who is swept through different phases of his life, from a Hungarian housing estate to the world of the ultra-rich in London. It has been praised. It's been praised for minimalist spare prose, which I usually love. And Roddy Doyle, who was one of the judges on the panel, said what we particularly liked about Flesh was its singularity. It's dark, but it's a real joy to read. I abandoned this book after the first 60 pages, and even the 60 pages was a push. It felt debaucherous and salacious and completely empty to me. And it again just proved that one man's view of writing as clever and spare and sharp feels to another as hollow and unsatisfying. But don't take my word for it. I've already had hot debates with various readers around this book, and I know that there were those who have found it as unputdownable as I have found it unreadable. So if you have read it, I'd love to know what you think. Let me know on the SMS line 061-895-1019. And then in South Africa, we have the Sunday Times Literary Awards. Those really are the most prestigious awards in the country. They were announced in December. And the fiction prize winner was a book called The Lost Love of Akbar Manzil. And if you love magic realism, as I do, so fiction with a touch of real magic, you will love this. The author is Shubnam Khan. And it's set in a crumbling seaside mansion in Durban, encompassing all the meatiest aspects of the human condition: jealousy, hopelessness, cynicism, curiosity, wonder, and magic. And then Kumisho Mugurani won the prize for nonfiction with a book called Morafe: Person, Family, and Nation in Colonial Botswana Land. And in Morafe, she wrote really a very important exploration of two generations of the prominent Malema family. They were so-called border people who straddled what would then become South Africa and Botswana. And it's been highly praised and a very important addition to South African history and the telling of stories from a different perspective that perhaps hasn't been captured before. The National Book Award winners for 2025 awarded a book that I had never heard of. It's called The True Story of Raja the Gullible and His Mother. And it's by Rabi Alamadine. It's so enticing, and it's on my TBR list, which means to be read. As you can imagine, it's a tottering pile. And it's the story is set in Beirut, in a small apartment where 63-year-old Raja and his mother live side by side. A philosophy teacher and the neighborhood homosexual, Raja relishes in books, meditative walks, and solitude. And his octogenarian mother views her son's desire for privacy as a personal affront and demands to know every detail of his life. And then Raja receives an invite to a writing residency in America. And the timing could not be better. It arrives on the heels of a number of national and personal disasters that have left Raja longing for peace and quiet away from his mother and the heartache of Lebanon. But then what seems like a stroke of good fortune leaves Raja to recount and relive the very past he wishes to forget. I think reading about a place like Lebanon offers us a very different view of a country that we have both opinions and thoughts around, and certainly worth reading. It sounds delicious to me, and I've got it next to my bed.
Turn the page. It's The Bookmark with Batya Bricker.
Welcome back. This is Batya Bricker, and you are listening to Bookmark, Chai FM's dedicated book show for books and the readers and people who love them. Today we are joined by Maya Arad. She's an Israeli-born author, now based in California, and she's widely considered the foremost Hebrew writer living outside of Israel. She's a writer in residence at Stanford University, the Taub Center for Jewish Studies. And this year, Maya's book, The Hebrew Teacher, won the Jewish Book Council's National Book Award for the best work of Hebrew fiction in translation. And I myself do not read in Hebrew, although I can read Hebrew. And this is the first translation of Maya's work into English. So although Maya is much celebrated as an accomplished writer in Hebrew, I, for one, am so grateful that Jessica Cohen has finally made her work available to English readers like myself. Maya, a very warm welcome to the show.
Thank you, Batya. It's a pleasure to be here.
Maya, do you think awards are important now that you've just won one?
Well, it's a complicated question. There's no yes and no. But I think in these times when people read less and less, awards is a kind of a recognition that, you know, give you some kind of confirmation and affirmation for your hard work, and maybe makes your work known to people who might not hear about it otherwise. And I can share, you know, maybe a unique perspective of mine as a Hebrew writer who lives outside Israel. I was shortlisted three times for the Sapir Prize in Israel, which is the most prestigious literary award in Israel. And about 10, 11 years ago, it was decided that writers who live outside Israel are no longer eligible for this prize. And, you know, it stung, but in a way it was also empowering, because it was as if the literary establishment in Israel acknowledged that there is a Hebrew diaspora of writers who are strong enough, you know, might be contestants for this prize. And in fact, all this happened after the prize was awarded to Ruby Namdar, a Hebrew writer who lives in New York. So I remember myself thinking, you know, I don't need this prize. I have my readership in Israel. I'm known. But, you know, what would it do to young emerging authors, right? It blocks their way to be recognized further. Well, so yes, they are, prizes are important, yeah.
Yeah, I think prizes are important, but I think it's so interesting what you speak about, because in South Africa, we have this conversation a lot. There are so many expat South Africans. So there are many writers writing about the South African experience who no longer live here. And in fact, the stance on most of our prizes, like the Sunday Times Prize, for example, is that they do accept submissions from authors, South African authors who write about a South African experience who may not be based here. It's an interesting conversation. When you leave the country of your birth, what exactly does that mean about how you understand its experience?
Yes, actually, it's fascinating. I'm glad you told me about that. You know, as I spent more and more time outside Israel, my topics tend to cover more and more the lives of Israeli expats in the U.S., as you can tell from the Hebrew teacher.
Yes.
So, and I'm very grateful that the readers in Israel are eager to read about this experience, to include this as part of the, you know, topics that are covered by Hebrew literature. Because when I was growing up, Hebrew literature was geographically contained in the land of Israel.
I'm
there was
sure.
No. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure. And I think just the fact that I can now access your writing makes me very happy. So I'm very happy that it's been translated, and it's been translated for people like me, not as an American, but as a Jew or somebody interested in Israel and Hebrew outside of Israel. So, you know, I'm not alone. There are lots of us. So I'm very happy that you're reaching us.
Thank you. And since you mentioned the translation, I want to give another shout out to Jessica Cohen, who really did a superb job. And she's so meticulous, and she's really truly bilingual, not only linguistically, but also culturally. She knows both cultures. So her translation, and I should mention maybe that, you know, her family originally came from South Africa. So.
Oh, really? Oh, that's a lovely connection. Thank you for that. Well, let's start with the first story. So the book follows in three novellas the lives of three Israeli expat women now living in the United States, and they're navigating life and identity. Identity, and it's complex and layered. And I have to tell you that as a South African Jew, strongly affiliated with Israel, each one punched me in the gut in a different way and touched me. So although it's about Israelis, I would say it's much broader than that. So let's start with the first novella. It's about Ilana, and she's a veteran Hebrew instructor at a Midwestern college who's built her life around her career. And a young Hebrew professor, Yoad, joins the facility or the faculty, and she finds that his post-Zionist politics pose a threat to her life's work, her sense of identity, her sense of pride, her sense of Jewishness. Maya, are you Ilana? You are currently writer in residence at Stanford University. Is this story your lived experience?
Yes and no. So it's People ask me a lot, what made you write about Ilana? Because Ilana is very different from me. She's about a generation older than me. She proudly says I was born along with Israel in 1948. She lives in the Midwest. I live in California. I live within the Israeli expat community of Silicon Valley. And Ilana lives within the Jewish community of her small university town somewhere in the Midwest. She belongs to a shul. I was raised in Israel. I grew up in a kibbutz. I'm very secular. So we're very, very different. But on another level, we're both Israeli women who live in America and make a living somewhere or other off Hebrew. And it's not a very good time for Hebrew. So in this respect, I could, relate to Ilana viscerally. And I know that on the surface, it's a story about a Hebrew teacher and, political conflicts and ideological conflicts. But it's also a story about growing old, feeling that you're losing relevance, that your life's work is being marginalized after being very central. And, this is something that I, as a Hebrew writer, can feel. Maybe as a writer in general, I know Hebrew literature best, because when I was coming of age as a reader in Israel in the 1980s, literature had a special status within culture. It was considered higher than all other cultural expressions, and being a writer was. And today, for better or worse, people read less. We have other things. It also means that, there are other wonderful forms of artistic expressions, like TV series and things like that. But people read less, and the feeling is that, yes, it's not a very good time for Hebrew, for Hebrew literature, for literature in general. I'm married to a historian at Stanford University, and he reads this story as an elegy to the humanities in America.
Yes, yeah, because
so I guess,
because
yeah, we all can feel, this feeling of losing relevance in a way.
It is interesting because the interest in languages in general is something that you talk about in the book, which I took small comfort from. I thought, oh, okay, well, if all the languages have been affected, then maybe things are not so bad. But that opening line, and you allude to it, it wasn't a very good time for Hebrew. And wow, it's a very strong line because, well, it isn't a very good time to be Jewish. I never thought I'd say that in my lifetime. Certainly my parents didn't. It's a post-7th of October world, and it cuts very deep, that kind of sense of identity, no matter where you live and no matter your affiliation to Israel. So it does start to raise questions of relevance, whoever you are, I think. You do something very clever, if I may say. In Ilana and Yoad, you set up two different camps: political views, temperaments, lifestyles, values. Just talk to me a little bit about it. You hinted at it, but can you unpack it more?
Yes. So it's true that it's not easy, and it takes, I think, some skill to distinguish between, Yoad's political views and the annoying and very abrasive way that he expresses them. And this is something that I fear, that people will read the story in a somewhat simplistic way. Oh, this is the Ilana is good, Yoad is bad, and so on. But it really takes two to tango, because Ilana is a kind person and she has a very good heart, but she can also have some blind spots, and you can tell that she's rubbing Yoad the wrong way. And you can see why we would get mad at her, the way she lectures to him. She tells him, you should do this and that, and you should really go to Hillel. You can see why she annoys him. Of course, it does not justify the way he treats her. And, the way I put it, there's a point in the story where Ilana is actually happy about Yoad's annoying and abrasive ways, when he tells off her frenemy, Hedy, who goes to him and says, oh, I have lots of family in Israel. My sister lives in Maale Adumim. And Yoad tells her, no, your sister doesn't live in Israel, because Maale Adumim is Palestine, is not Israel. Now, I belong to the hardcore of the Israeli left. And ever since I was 15, I refused to join a school trip to the West Bank, because, did not want to support the occupation. And for me, I had a reading in Jerusalem where half the audience was from the West Bank. And I told them, I'm very glad you're coming to meet me in Jerusalem, because I will not travel to the settlements in the West Bank, but I'm glad to meet you and talk to you. And I read this part and said, you know, for me too, Maale Adumim is not part of Israel, but I would never speak like this to an older woman and, you know, offend her like that. So, you know, Yoad is a bird person because of the way he treats Hedi, not because he thinks that Maale Adumim
yes.
is not part of Israel.
I think that what's clever, though, is that the political views aside, I personally wouldn't want Yoad around my Friday night table. And it kind of reminds me of Judge Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who spoke so eloquently about how you can disagree without being disagreeable. But I did find myself as the reader wondering if it was Yoad's abrasive personality or his views, which I don't share, that made me so uncomfortable. And you set that up.
Yeah. I guess it's more the way, you know, he expresses his views, and it goes together with so many other things. Like, for example, refusing to speak to the people at the book club. I mean, you can say I'm too busy, I'm sorry, I can't do that. But, you know, the way he says this, I don't want to entertain a gaggle of old ladies or something like that. So I think it's really more of his abrasive ways, because as you said, in the name of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, yes, there are ways to disagree without being disagreeable.
Yeah. Well, I think the next story is called A Visit in Scenes. And if the first story resonated with me around my own questions of Jewish identity and Jewish pride and nationality, the second one struck a deeply personal chord, and it spoke to me both as a mother, as a daughter, and as a daughter-in-law. Because Miriam, whose son leaves Israel to make his fortune in Silicon Valley, pays an unwanted visit to meet her grandson. She wants to meet her grandson, we all get that. And she discovers cracks in the family's perfect facade. You tell the story in multiple voices. So we hear from Miriam, who's the mom and the safta, who just wants to connect with her son and grandson. You give us the perspective of Maya, who is the daughter-in-law, who is left to entertain this basic stranger in her own home, in her own space, for 3 whole weeks, while her husband, Yoram, off he goes. He's never around. He's at work, and he's curt, and he's distant, and he's largely absent. Why did you choose multiple narrators?
So first of all, I'm really glad about the way you presented the story, because so many people read it and told me, what a terrible daughter-in-law. And I said, I mean, what about the son? It's his mother. I mean, she's the one who's left to entertain her, just like you said. So thank you for that. You know, it's sometimes the way things work for me as a writer is not necessarily, okay, now I will explore it in 3 different voices. It just felt right, maybe because these are such 3 different people and each of them has a point of view that's valid, that I really felt I needed, you know, 3 points of view in a way that was not needed in the first story with Ilana and Yoad, where, you know, Ilana is the one whose point of view is presented. So I really wanted, you know, to see, it's like, you know, a little crystal ball that we need to look at all sides to see everyone's perspective. And you know, each person has a valid perspective. And just like in the first story with Ilana and Yoad, it's true that, you know, there's no real villain. Of course, the son and daughter-in-law are not very nice, but, you know, the mother just comes unannounced and for 3 weeks, because, you know, it's very far to go to California, so she wants to stay a while. And she also has a way of, for example, she tells her daughter-in-law, Maya, why does the Jonathan, the grandson, why doesn't he speak? Yoram was speaking whole sentences at his age. I don't know any daughter-in-law who loves to hear such things. So yeah, she can annoy her, and she doesn't get that, you know, Maya is working on her PhD thesis, so she's working at home. To her, she just seems, you know, sitting at home all day. So she interrupts her with questions and all those things. So of course, you know, it can get on her nerves.
I get that she's quite clumsy, Miriam, in the way that she is trying to connect. But do you think that Maya and Yoram were trying to connect too? Because it didn't feel like they wanted to connect with her.
You're right, yes. I mean, I think from their point of view, they're just trying to pass those 3 weeks, you know, and go through it and, yeah. But, you know, there are so many little misunderstandings. For example, when Miriam comes and she lands there, and the grandson is at preschool. So she says, "Can you at least show me some pictures?" And instead of, a photo album, Maya picks up her phone and shows her some pictures on the phone. So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that is just
Miriam
generational
doesn't
gap.
live into, yeah, she's in her late 70s, and in some ways she seems to be way older, not living in today's world, not knowing how kids are.
Yeah, it's I like that example because it was heartbreaking for me that she didn't have photos of Jonathan. But in Maya's world, but here yeah, they're on the screen, they're on my phone. Here are photos. I'll just send them to you. Yeah, it's interesting. And then in the course of her travels, Miriam meets Malka, and you set up the kind of Malka-Ravit relationship versus Miriam and Maya. Talk to us a little bit about that.
So Miriam meets, I think, Malka on the plane, and Malka takes care of her and helps her throughout immigration. And then they keep in touch because Malka is also, came to visit her son and daughter-in-law and meet her grandchildren. But of course, the relationship is completely opposite because Malka's daughter-in-law is a stay-at-home mom who has a lot of time to take care of her and walk her around. And they seem to like each other a lot. And of course, people like Maya may look down on them because, she stays home all day. She's not doing a PhD like me. But for Malka, it's such a joy, to spend time with her daughter-in-law. And they go shopping and they go to the little petting zoo with their granddaughter and they do things. So, and they're so kind that, they re pretty soon they figure out the situation of Miriam at her son's house. So they take her along with them. So she spends her time with them instead of with her own family. And it's very touching, I think, the way they take care of her.
It's moving and heartbreaking, and it's kind of when you think, oh, I'm not a grandmother yet, but it's you really hope that's not going to happen to your relationship with your grandchild. So it cuts really deep. The third story is called Make New Friends. We don't have time to go into it, but it cuts really as deep as the others because it touches on something that we have all felt some point in our lives, the pain of social exclusion, of feeling left out. And Efrat is the protagonist, and she tries to help her daughter navigate the challenges of middle school, trying to navigate friendships and social dynamics. And it's as much about Efrat fitting in as it is about her daughter. And I think we've all experienced that on both sides of that divide. All three novellas blend irony and sensitivity. They probe the deepest parts of our identity, personal and national. And it occurred to me that if there had just been warmth between the characters, it might have changed the outcome and experience of each story. What do you think is common between all three of these?
So first of all, just if there was just warmth, I have a friend who, after reading this book in Hebrew, and she read the second story about the grandmother Miriam, and she called me and she said, "Why are they like that?" And I told her, "Because if they weren't like that, I wouldn't have a story." So yeah, that's the short answer. There's a very obvious common theme about women and immigration, and families and immigration, and how families are affected by immigration. We have, two women who actually immigrated, and one woman who was affected after her only son immigrated and she was left behind. That's Miriam. So I guess, yeah. But if I had to choose one word, I would say families, because that's what most literature is about.
Yes, and
But if you give
navigating.
me two words, then family and immigration, yeah.
And what would you like the reader to take away from your book?
Wow, that's a tough one because you write a book and you don't really think what. Maybe we should go back to what we started with because I want readers to appreciate how complicated family life is and immigration is and so on. But right after October 7, I was asked, what's your role as a writer? And I said, I'm a writer. I'm not, a professional, a psychologist who can help people or a doctor. But, if someone just read this book seriously, I have Israeli characters, full of flaws, and they're not perfect, but they're real human beings. If someone would be willing to read about Israelis as human beings, not just as, you know, ideological figures or something like that. Or that's what I would want them to take from the book.
Maya, thank you for joining us. It's been an absolute honor to talk to you. Maya Arad's book, The Hebrew Teacher, is available in South Africa by special order only. I ordered it from Exclusive Books in Hyde Park, but I can tell you that it's worth the effort and worth the wait. Look out for more from Maya Arad in English in the coming months and years. We're going to see more and more. It's you're going to hear a voice full of sharp wisdom and insight, and it's a voice you're going to want to follow.
Turn the page. It's The Bookmark with Batya Bricker.
Welcome back. I'm Batya Bricker, and you're listening to 101.9 Chai FM's book show Bookmark. The last book, as you know, I often save the best for last, is called Mona's Eyes, and it was awarded the Barnes & Noble Book of the Year for 2025. I often follow the bookstore's choice of Book of the Year, Waterstones, Barnes & Noble, simply, and the Independents, obviously, simply because these are books that booksellers loved selling and that readers love to buy. So it's a very good indication of a kind of pleasure index that you know you're going to read a book that so many readers have absolutely loved. Mona's Eyes has been translated from the French into 38 languages, including Braille, and you'll see why now. It was translated in English by the same translator as Valerie Perrin's books. You may know Fresh Water for Flowers. Her name is Christelle Dabos, and she did the translation. So this book is about Mona, who has a brief episode of blindness. And the doctors can find no explanation for it, but there is a threat of permanent vision loss that cannot be ruled out. Her parents, obviously deeply distressed, and they put her in all kinds of therapy to come to terms with the fact that she might be turning blind. And so the girl's grandfather has been, Henry, has been appointed as the man to take her to the psychiatrist once a week. But instead of that, they abscond and they visit Paris's well-known museums because her grandfather feels that if she is losing her sight, he can fill the encroaching darkness with beauty and enormous memories and many memories of beauty. And so for 52 weeks, that's all the time Mona has left to learn about beauty before she may lose her eyesight forever. They visit 52 works of art. Every Wednesday, Henry picks her up after school and takes her to see a great work of art. First, they go to the Louvre, then Musée d'Orsay, and then the Beaubourg. From Botticelli to the Mona Lisa, Chagall to anyone you can think of, Manet. Mona learns how each artist's work shaped the world around them. And in turn, the young girl's world is changed forever by the power of their art. It's under the care and kindness and careful tutelage of her grandfather. And she learns the true meaning of generosity, melancholy, love, loss, and revolution. Her perspective will never be the same, and nor will the reader's. Now, the book jacket is as special as the book. You will find all 52 works of art in a fold-out jacket that covers that is the cover of the book. So I have spent every chapter unfolding that cover again and looking at the particular piece of work. And then I must confess, going on to Google and finding more information and doing kind of close-ups. Amazing things like when it became common practice for a signature to go on the bottom right-hand corner of a painting, and he gives the whole history of that, because before then, artists would sign their work wherever they felt it worked with the painting. I love the idea of that. Thomas Schleser is the author, and he is the director of the Foundation Hertung Bergmann, which is both a museum and an artistic research center. But he also teaches art history in Paris. And so this book is as much a workshop in the 52 great works of art that are housed in Paris as it is a story. It's a spectacular romp through the centuries of art and humans finding their way to understand the world through art. And it's as if you are walking through those top galleries in Paris. It made me want to pack my bag and go for real. It's profound. It's moving. I have to say just one slight thing. You do have to suspend a little bit of belief because the conversations are of a very high level. And I do wonder that if a real Mona, a real little girl, would be able to follow conversations like that or perceive the depth of meaning in what he covers. But it is exceptional. It's a complete treat. And I think a shout out from Miriam Gordas captures the book well. She says, imagine an acclaimed art historian has written all the light we cannot see. This is Mona's eyes. A word from our sponsors. Even in times of darkness, you can choose to shine our light. We can choose to shine our light and uplift one another. So join the community to commemorate Yom HaZikaron on Monday, the 20th of April. It'll be a moving ceremony where we carry the light for Israel's fallen and victims of terror. Gates open at 6 and proceedings begin at 6:30 sharp. And then on Tuesday, the 21st of April, bring along the whole family and be the light as we celebrate Yom HaAtzmaut together. There'll be rides, food stalls, school performances, and top local entertainers. Gates open at 4 p.m. and proceedings start at 6. For information, go to the South African Zionist Federation, sazf.org/78. Don't miss Yom HaZikaron and Yom HaAtzmaut, two incredible community events brought to you by the South African Zionist Federation, your connection to Israel in South Africa.
Turn the page. It's The Bookmark with Batya Bricker.
We have spent the last hour or so delving into books that have won awards and accolades. There are brilliant books that will never make the shortlist and perfectly respectable books that somehow walk away with a trophy but don't really deserve it. But what awards do is that they create conversation. They give us a shared language of literary moments, and they invite us to read beyond our usual genres and geographies and comfort zones. I love that, by the way. They nudge us, sometimes gently and sometimes forcefully, towards books that we might not have chosen for ourselves. So perhaps the real question isn't whether award-winning books are good, but rather what kind of reading experience can they offer us? Are they stretching us, unsettling us, illuminating us as we might not have seen before? Are they reflecting the world as it is, as it might be, or as someone else sees it? And just as importantly, do we as readers feel changed after we've read them? So I hope that you have enjoyed this feature on award-winning books and the conversation with Maya Arad, which was an enormous treat for me. Join me next week for books that will fill both your soul and your cup. Goodbye and happy reading.